Escuelas Oficiales de Idiomas de la Comunidad Autónoma de Canarias. Pruebas de certificación de nivel avanzado C2 de inglés. Convocatoria ordinaria de 2023. Prueba de comprensión de textos orales. Esta parte consta de 3 tareas. Escuchará cada grabación 2 veces. Escuche y lea las instrucciones al principio de cada tarea y realícela según se indica. Las respuestas escritas a lápiz o en tinta roja no se calificarán. No está permitido el uso del diccionario. El uso de cualquier dispositivo electrónico queda prohibido durante la prueba. El móvil tendrá que permanecer apagado y guardado. Atención, no escriba en los recuadros sombreados. Son espacios reservados para la calificación de las tareas.
Task 1. Listen to 6 extracts from an interview about work and match them 1 to 6 to the phrase A to J that best corresponds to each one. Write your answers in the table provided. There are 3 extra phrases you do not need. Extract 0 is an example. Now you have 1 minute to read the task. Extract 0. Example.
What we often call the male breadwinner model has been, you know, a kind of division of labor between genders that has basically been around since the start of industrialism. You know, the birth of the working class, the industrial working class, was premised on there being someone at home, a woman to look after the kids, prepare the meals, nurturing and looking after the male worker who comes back exhausted from the industrial grind, basically.
Extract 1.
Now in the area of COVID, you're kind of in your living room with your laptop, so it's hard to switch off. That's been a kind of creep which has kind of infiltrated our working lives. And I think, you know, it's safe to say that it's to the detriment of most people that it's hard to switch off. It's hard to make distinctions between your free time and your work time. I think you didn't have that in a much more manufacturing-based, kind of factory-based system where you could leave the factory, go home, you know, when you clocked in, clocked out. And that's not even talking about the housework, the unpaid work and so on.
Extract 2.
If we're talking about working time reduction, this is particularly relevant to women who both have their paid employment and their unpaid work at home. So if you're talking about reducing hours in general, this will first and foremost benefit those who work the longest hours in total. At the same time, if you look at the kind of most stressful and exhausting and kind of poor, the jobs with the poorest working conditions in our society, they're often carried out by women. So we're talking about hospitality workers, you know, waitresses, or carers, nurses, teachers, for example.
Extract 3.
Now that's not just because of the kind of work people are doing, the production, so manufacturing and construction being obviously very carbon intensive and so on. It's also because of the consumption that goes on around work. So things like commuting. If people drive to work, that's a huge carbon burden. If you're taking ready meals and bottled water, kind of these kind of quick, easy food that come with a work-centered lifestyle. So I think any discussion of the future of environmental sustainability should talk about the way that we work and how long we work for.
Extract 4.
social campaigns, trade unions, and then finally we should talk about politicians. So we mentioned in the book a number of politicians are waking up to this issue. One other actor to mention I think shouldn't be ignored are those first adopters, those early movers, those firms and those organizations who are, and we've worked with many of them, who are already running this for their staff. They want to be seen as good employers. They want to attract staff, retain staff, give kind of better working conditions. That shouldn't be sniffed at. We should encourage and point to these precedents.
Extract 5.
What you lose in labour time, you gain in greater productivity on the job. So that's a lot of desk-based work. So creative organisations or lots of administrative organisations, but not just them, but small manufacturers as well. There's a recognition that actually for 8 hours a day, there is some slack. We can't concentrate all the time, particularly if you're overworked and you have burnout. And so reducing the working week has reaped dividends in terms of productivity and worker well-being, which means they come to work refreshed, they come to work liking their job a bit more.
Extract 6.
But that's detrimental to overall working culture, in our view, because a decent working culture would be that the quality of work's good, everyone's playing their role, and there's decent collaboration within the team. It's not about individually proving that you're a harder worker than others. And so just laying down some firm guidelines and ground rules about what working hours are and what's expected of staff, that's what needs to be in place to basically avoid some of this kind of overwork culture, which is often at play.
Listen again. Extract 0. Example.
What we often call the male breadwinner model has been, you know, a kind of division of labour between genders that has basically been around since the start of industrialism. You know, the birth of the working class, the industrial working class, was premised on there being someone at home, a woman to look after the kids, prepare the meals, nurturing and looking after the male worker who comes back exhausted from the industrial grind, basically.
Extract 1.
Now in the area of COVID, you're kind of in your living room with your laptop, so it's hard to switch off. That's been a kind of creep which has kind of infiltrated our working lives. And I think, you know, it's safe to say that it's to the detriment of most people that it's hard to switch off. It's hard to make distinctions between your free time and your work time. I think you didn't have that in a much more manufacturing-based, kind of factory-based system where you could leave the factory, go home, you know, when you clocked in, clocked out. And that's not even talking about the housework, the unpaid work and so on.
Extract 2.
If we're talking about working time reduction, this is particularly relevant to women who both have their paid employment and their unpaid work at home. So if you're talking about reducing hours in general, this will first and foremost benefit those who work the longest hours in total. At the same time, if you look at the kind of most stressful and exhausting and kind of poor, the jobs with the poorest working conditions in our society, they're often carried out by women. So we're talking about hospitality workers, you know, waitresses, or carers, nurses, teachers, for example.
Extract 3.
And that's not just because of the kind of work people do in the production, so manufacturing and construction being obviously very carbon intensive and so on. It's also because of the consumption that goes on around work. So things like commuting. If people drive to work, that's a huge carbon burden. If you're taking ready meals and bottled water, kind of these kind of quick, easy food that come with a work-centered lifestyle. So I think any discussion of the future of environmental sustainability should talk about the way that we work and how long we work for.
Extract 4.
Social campaigns, trade unions, and then finally we should talk about politicians. So we mentioned in the book a number of politicians are waking up to this issue. One other actor to mention I think shouldn't be ignored are those first adopters, those early movers, those firms and those organizations who are, and we've worked with many of them, who are already running this for their staff. They want to be seen as good employers. They want to attract staff, retain staff, give kind of better working conditions. That shouldn't be sniffed at. We should encourage and point to these precedents.
Extract 5.
What you lose in labour time, you gain in greater productivity on the job. So that's a lot of desk-based work. So creative organisations or lots of administrative organisations, but not just them, but small manufacturers as well. There's a recognition that actually for 8 hours a day, there is some slack. We can't concentrate all the time, particularly if you're overworked and you have burnout. And so reducing the working week has reaped dividends in terms of productivity and worker well-being, which means they come to work refreshed, they come to work liking their job a bit more.
Extract 6.
But that's detrimental to overall working culture, in our view, because a decent working culture would be that the quality of work works good, everyone's playing their role, and there's decent collaboration within the team. It's not about individually proving that you're a harder worker than others. And so just laying down some firm guidelines and ground rules about what working hours are and what's expected of staff, that's what needs to be in place to basically avoid some of this kind of overwork culture, which is often at play.
This is the end of task 1. Now turn to task 2. Task 2. Listen to an online lesson about cultural diversity and answer the following questions. Write your answers in the table provided. Do not use more than 8 words. Question 0 is an example. Now you have 1 minute and 30 seconds to read the task.
In 2019, the World Health Organization estimated that there are about 1 billion migrants in the world, nearly 1 in 8 people. This means that more than ever before, we live in societies made out of many cultures, and this diversity can be a beautiful thing. In Australia, Harmony Day is celebrated on the 21st of March each year and aims to grow inclusiveness, respect, and a sense of belonging for everyone. But the very fact that this course needs to be fought for implies that it's not something everyone naturally does. Cultures can have very fundamental differences, and this can lead to stereotypes, prejudice, and discrimination. I spoke in a previous video lesson about how stereotypes can be understood using the tri-component model of attitudes. You can probably see how it can be applied to the way cultural groups perceive each other. It's not difficult for prejudice to occur in how individuals might think or feel about people in another group, and this can lead to discrimination in their behavior. However, some factors make prejudice more likely to happen. For example, a cultural insensitivity or lack of awareness. There are often cultural reasons why a person may choose not to eat a certain food or work on a certain day. But if someone else didn't know that, they might assume that the person was being unnecessarily fussy or lazy. Different cultures may also have different approaches to completing tasks or making decisions. For example, in Indigenous Australian culture, big decisions are only made after a majority has been reached in the clan. This can be frustrating for someone who doesn't understand this cultural norm and perhaps comes from a more individualistic culture where everyone makes their own decisions. And finally, differences in verbal and nonverbal communication styles can also result in potential conflict. All this conflict and frustration that can arise due to these factors may result in the formation of stereotypes, which in turn may develop into prejudice. When it comes to issues of cultural diversity, this prejudice may be expressed as xenophobia, ethnocentrism, and racism. Let's look at each of those. Xenophobia can be described as the fear of or strong animosity towards people of different races or cultural backgrounds. For some people, this is a default position. They're often really just afraid of the impact that the foreign cultural ideals might have on the status quo in the majority culture. However, this ends up leading to an immediate distrust of any culture apart from their own. Ethnocentrism is another expression of this, the belief that your own ethnicity or culture is superior to all the others. This can be used to justify excluding other cultures into society or wanting to stop immigrants altogether. And finally, racism, which are negative emotions or actions towards someone simply based on their race. It's similar to ethnocentrism in that there's the belief that one's own race is the most superior. In 2018, a manager at Starbucks in the United States called the police on two African-American men in her store who were waiting for their friend to arrive for a meeting. She will later argue that they hadn't bought anything and were just sitting in the store, but the two men ended up getting arrested by the police and removed, although they ended up not being charged with anything. There were other customers who filmed the event and told the media that they had not bought anything either, but had not been asked to leave. Examples of explicit racism include the actions of hate groups, such as neo-Nazis and white nationalists, racial slurs or derogatory terms, or when people openly talk negatively about particular cultural groups. Political parties can also express racist policies and openly attack certain cultures. But implicit racism is harder to detect because it's often unconscious or concealed. However, it still ends up impacting the judgments and decisions that people make towards people from different cultures or ethnic groups. The Starbucks manager may have acted the way she did out of implicit racism. Other examples include police pulling drivers over due to the color of their skin, people mistrusting those who look different from them, juries being more likely to pronounce a suspect as guilty based on their race, and more. A month after the incident, Starbucks closed all 8,000 of the US stores for 4 hours to conduct training specifically aimed at reducing implicit racism and indeed implicit bias of any kind. Stores in Canada followed suit not long after. But was that enough? Many experts suggest that racism is embedded far deeper than a single workshop can reveal. A continued effort must be made if we're to address racism, both explicit and implicit, as one of the main challenges that cultural diversity presents. Is it possible for Harmony Day to be every day? We may not know, but it's definitely worth trying.
Listen again.
In 2019, the World Health Organization estimated that there are about 1 billion migrants in the world, nearly 1 in 8 people. This means that more than ever before, we live in societies made out of many cultures, and this diversity can be a beautiful thing. In Australia, Harmony Day is celebrated on the 21st of March each year and aims to grow inclusiveness, respect, and a sense of belonging for everyone. But the very fact that this cause needs to be fought for implies that it's not something everyone naturally does. Cultures can have very fundamental differences, and this can lead to stereotypes, prejudice, and discrimination. I spoke in a previous video lesson about how stereotypes can be understood using the tri-component model of attitudes. You can probably see how it can be applied to the way cultural groups perceive each other. It's not difficult for prejudice to occur in how individuals might think or feel about people in another group, and this can lead to discrimination in their behavior. However, some factors make prejudice more likely to happen. For example, a cultural insensitivity or lack of awareness. There are often cultural reasons why a person may choose not to eat a certain food or work on a certain day. But if someone else didn't know that, they might assume that the person was being unnecessarily fussy or lazy. Different cultures may also have different approaches to completing tasks or making decisions. For example, in Indigenous Australian culture, big decisions are only made after a majority has been reached in the clan. This can be frustrating for someone who doesn't understand this cultural norm and perhaps comes from a more individualistic culture where everyone makes their own decisions. And finally, differences in verbal and nonverbal communication styles can also result in potential conflict. All this conflict and frustration that can arise due to these factors may result in the formation of stereotypes, which in turn may develop into prejudice. When it comes to issues of cultural diversity, this prejudice may be expressed as xenophobia, ethnocentrism, and racism. Let's look at each of those. Xenophobia can be described as the fear of or strong animosity towards people of different races or cultural backgrounds. For some people, this is a default position. They're often really just afraid of the impact that the foreign cultural ideals might have on the status quo in the majority culture. However, this ends up leading to an immediate distrust of any culture apart from their own. Ethnocentrism is another expression of this, the belief that your own ethnicity or culture is superior to all the others. This can be used to justify excluding other cultures into society or wanting to stop immigrants altogether. And finally, racism, which are negative emotions or actions towards someone simply based on their race. It's similar to ethnocentrism in that there's the belief that one's own race is the most superior. In 2018, a manager at Starbucks in the United States called the police on two African-American men in her store who were waiting for their friend to arrive for a meeting. She will later argue that they hadn't bought anything and were just sitting in the store, but the two men ended up getting arrested by the police and removed, although they ended up not being charged with anything. There were other customers who filmed the event and told the media that they had not bought anything either, but had not been asked to leave. Examples of explicit racism include the actions of hate groups, such as neo-Nazis and white nationalists, racial slurs or derogatory terms, or when people openly talk negatively about particular cultural groups. Political parties can also express racist policies and openly attack certain cultures. But implicit racism is harder to detect because it's often unconscious or concealed. However, it still ends up impacting the judgments and decisions that people make towards people from different cultures or ethnic groups. The Starbucks manager may have acted the way she did out of implicit racism. Other examples include police pulling drivers over due to the color of their skin, people mistrusting those who look different from them, juries being more likely to pronounce a suspect as guilty based on their race, and more. A month after the incident, Starbucks closed all 8,000 of the US stores for 4 hours to conduct training specifically aimed at reducing implicit racism and indeed implicit bias of any kind. Stores in Canada followed suit not long after. But was that enough? Many experts suggest that racism is embedded far deeper than a single workshop can reveal. A continued effort must be made if we're to address racism, both explicit and implicit, as one of the main challenges that cultural diversity presents. Is it possible for Harmony Day to be every day? We may not know, but it's definitely worth trying.
This is the end of task 2. Now turn to task 3. Task 3. Listen to an extract from an interview with comedian Tig Notaro. Decide if the sentences 1 to 10 are true or false according to the interview. Write your answers, true or false, in the table provided. Sentence 0 is an example. Now you have 1 minute and 30 seconds to read the task.
Personally, I think I'm pretty funny, for a neurosurgeon at least, but for today's episode, I really wanted to talk to a professional, so I reached out to comedian Tig Notaro. She joined me from her home in Los Angeles, where she lives with her wife Stephanie and their 5-year-old twin sons, Max and Finn, and from what she tells me, it's a pretty laughter-filled household.
I always say that I live in a house full of writers, because they're all just writing my material and books and whatever it is that I hope to do, they're all working on it.
I have always been fascinated by funny people. I've been fascinated by stand-up comics because I think that their brains just work really fast. I think that they see the connections that other people maybe don't see. And then as soon as they say it, it was mm-hmm. always there. And I just wonder, is that what it's like for you? Do you see things that other people should see but miss? Do you find connections? Do you state the obvious in some ways that no one else is willing to state?
Well, I mean, it can work like that. And some comedians do work like that. I mean, there's plenty of comedians that haven't had what I would think is an interesting or new thought at all. It's just like a certain delivery and cadence that they're delivering recycled ideas that comedians have done a million times. And a lot of times that is comedy, is you're seeing the same thing over and over, but from different angles and delivering it differently and having a different twist on it. You know, I remember I had a podcast years ago, like a decade ago, and we had this guy on that was completely unfamiliar with me. And he was talking about how, you know, there's certain things you just can't make jokes about. One of them is cancer. And I was sitting there having just done a performance where I made jokes about my cancer diagnosis. And, you know, my album ended up becoming the number one comedy album in the world that year. And so I was sitting there saying, so you're saying there is no situation where a person could make a joke about cancer? And he said, absolutely not. I've lost people to cancer. It's not funny. And my point is, of course, it's not funny to lose people or to suffer from that disease or any sort of suffering. It's the unknown and unsuspected way of approaching the topic or the comedy that can floor you and make you go, gosh, I can't believe I just laughed at that topic.
But it's interesting to me. Like, I'm curious for you, like 2012, I know was a really challenging year for you.
Yes, it was. In 4 months, I had pneumonia, C. diff, invasive cancer, my mother tripped and died, and my girlfriend and I split up. And then after I had my surgery and I was returning to comedy, I kept thinking, God, I would love to take my shirt off and just tell jokes and not talk about cancer, because I feel like that would make it silly. You know, that would be able to make a statement, but also be a comedian about the statement.
What was that like? I mean, I know it was an incredible moment for audiences, but for you, did you get out of it what you thought you would?
It was very cathartic. I could feel it in the room. I could feel it in my body. I was so scared to Google images of double mastectomies, and I was so scared for so long. And once I went through it and I looked at myself and I thought, okay, I have scars across my chest. And I thought, a scar just means you healed. And that's how I started to process my life post-surgery. And then I felt empowered at that point, where I was like, yeah, I feel comfortable and I'm okay that my body has scars. And then I thought, how awesome to just take off my shirt and talk about airplanes. And so I did that in my HBO special.
Was it cathartic for you? Did you feel different?
It was very cathartic. I could feel it in the room. I could feel it in my body. I just thought, I always tell people, I used to take really unsafe risks as a kid. I would, you know, I smoked cigarettes. I was a high school dropout. I just was kind of, you know, just, I was that kid. And I turned my life around as an adult, and I started taking risks in comedy. And it's always, even if I bomb, it always is a payoff. Because that risk just feels so electric to me. And when I picture myself taking that risk and jumping from one side to the other and landing on my feet on the other side, I'm like, God, nothing feels better than this. And after I went on tour, after having had my cancer diagnosis and releasing my album and getting all the support I did from friends and family and strangers, my follow-up tour, I made a point to go out to my merchandise booth and meet people and say hello to all the strangers in the world that embraced me and supported me and lifted me up. And I heard their stories, and they, of course, heard mine through my stand-up and my book and everything that I had released. And they, it was really, I could feel it. You know, I could feel that connection.
Listen again.
Personally, I think I'm pretty funny, for a neurosurgeon at least. But for today's episode, I really wanted to talk to a professional. So I reached out to comedian Tig Notaro. She joined me from her home in Los Angeles, where she lives with her wife Stephanie and their 5-year-old twin sons, Max and Finn. And from what she tells me, it's a pretty laughter-filled household.
I always say that I live in a house full of writers, because they're all just writing my material and books and whatever it is that I hope to do, they're all working on it.
I have always been fascinated by funny people. I've been fascinated by stand-up comics because I think that their brains just work really fast. I think that they see the connections that other people maybe don't see. And then as soon as they say it, it was always there. And I just wonder, is that what it's like for you? Do you see things that other people should see but miss? Do you find connections? Do you state the obvious in some ways that no one else is willing to state?
Well, I mean, it can work like that. And some comedians do work like that. I mean, there's plenty of comedians that haven't had what I would think is an interesting or new thought at all. It's just like a certain delivery and cadence that they're delivering recycled ideas that comedians have done a million times. And a lot of times that is comedy, is you're seeing the same thing over and over, but from different angles and delivering it differently and having a different twist on it. You know, I remember I had a podcast years ago, like a decade ago, and we had this guy on that was completely unfamiliar with me. And he was talking about how, you know, there's certain things you just can't make jokes about. One of them is cancer. And I was sitting there, having just done a performance where I made jokes about my cancer diagnosis. And, you know, my album ended up becoming the number one comedy album in the world that year. And so I was sitting there saying, so you're saying there is no situation where a person could make a joke about cancer? And he said, absolutely not. I've lost people to cancer. It's not funny. And my point is, of course, it's not funny to lose people or to suffer from that disease or any sort of suffering. It's the unknown and unsuspected way of approaching the topic or the comedy that can floor you and make you go, gosh, I can't believe I just laughed at that topic.
But it's interesting to me. Like, I'm curious for you, like 2012, I know was a really challenging year for you.
Yes, it was. In 4 months, I had pneumonia, C. diff, invasive cancer, my mother tripped and died, and my girlfriend and I split up. And then after I had my surgery, and I was returning to comedy, I kept thinking, God, I would love to take my shirt off and just tell jokes and not talk about cancer, because I feel like that would make it silly. You know, I would be able to make a statement, but also be a comedian about the statement.
What was that like? I mean, I know it was an incredible moment for audiences, but for you, did you get out of it what you thought you would?
It was very cathartic. I could feel it in the room. I could feel it in my body. I was so scared to Google images of double mastectomies, and I was so scared for so long. And once I went through it, and I looked at myself and I thought, okay, I have scars across my chest. And I thought, a scar just means you healed. And that's how I started to process my life post-surgery. And then I felt empowered at that point, where I was like, yeah, I feel comfortable and I'm okay that my body has scars. And then I thought, how awesome to just take off my shirt and talk about airplanes. And so I did that in my HBO special.
Was it cathartic for you? Did you feel different?
It was very cathartic. I could feel it in the room. I could feel it in my body. I just thought, I always tell people I used to take really unsafe risks as a kid. I would, you know, I smoked cigarettes. I was a high school dropout. I just was kind of, you know, just, I was that kid. And I turned my life around as an adult, and I started taking risks in comedy. And it's always, even if I bomb, it always is a payoff, because that risk just feels so electric to me. And when I picture myself taking that risk and jumping from one side to the other and landing on my feet on the other side, I'm like, God, nothing feels better than this. And after I went on tour, after having had my cancer diagnosis and releasing my album and getting all the support I did from friends and family and strangers, my follow-up tour, I made a point to go out to my merchandise booth and meet people and say hello to all the strangers in the world that embraced me and supported me and lifted me up. And I heard their stories, and they, of course, heard mine through my stand-up and my book and everything that I had released. And it was really, I could feel it. You know, I could feel that connection.
This is the end of task 3 and the end of the listening comprehension test.